I'm William Jess Laird. This is Image Culture. On the show today, I'm talking with artists and curators Liz Nielsen and Carolina Wheat. Together, Liz and Lena operate the Elijah Wheat Showroom, a Bushwick gallery committed to showing socially conscientious, politically engaged work outside the status quo. Their last show was Slap the Void, New Drawings by Francis Waite, and their current show is Persistence of Future Memories, featuring work by Annie Ewesquio and Amy O'Doom. Liz's own practice is in the long tradition of cameraless photography. However, her use of color, figurative composition, and scale creates a new space far removed from the early darkroom experiments of Moholy-Nagy and Man Ray. She works with photographic paper, gels, and hand-cut collage negatives to create unique photograms made in complete darkness. I also just want to say that I photograph all the guests on Image Culture, and you can see the portraits on Instagram at William Jess Laird. So here is my conversation with Liz and Lena, recorded at their home in Brooklyn. All right, cool. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, William.
Yeah, I mean, I thought maybe we could start kind of in reverse chronological order, and we could start with Elijah Wheat Showroom.
Well, we had initially thought about showing work of emerging artists and maintaining our gallery and curatorial experience. However, when we first moved to New York, we got so busy that with our full daytime jobs, at salary, you know, regular paycheck things, that world.
As one has to do.
Yeah. That we became, we kind of put it aside. And I remember coming back from Swimming Pool Project Space after we had moved to New York, from Brooklyn to Chicago for the Art Expo Chicago Fair, and they had put Swimming Pool Project Space from Brooklyn. And we were like, what? No, this is from Chicago. However, we had always intended, we looked at each other and we were like, we'll have that one day. We'll do that. And then when we had the time, we decided to create an LLC in the name of our son, who's now passed. He would be 20 and a half this holiday season, and we wanted to take the namesake of the gallery and really fulfill a lot of the qualities that Elijah Elisio Timbali Gortari Wheat had embodied, and, you know, a lot of righteousness. He always instigated conversation. He was very generous to his friends. He bucked the status quo. He loved to wear onesies well before they were on, you know, Amazon.
I saw the I saw the picture on the Elijah Wheat website. Is him in the onesie?
Yeah, we've got some good videos of that, and he was wearing those for a while. That was one of his favorites, the smiley face one.
I guess it also ties into from the last show I saw there, the mall show. We have these onesies for the resistance, right?
Yeah. Wear your resistance.
Snuggy onesies. Snuggies. They were snuggy onesies.
They were snuggies, and they, you know, they had different elements. Design incorporated from the batillery or the other the weapons that the police force and the armed cops would come in. The crowd control, or I want to call them the stormtroopers, but I can't remember when they get brought in.
They
get all the riot gear stuff.
They basically are stormtroopers.
Yeah, and so they have the rubber bullets and the zip
pepper
ties
spray.
And the pepper spray and all sorts of really harming things for peaceful protesters. And we really love those snuggies. It really makes sense because I remember when Elijah first came to New York about a year in with Zuccotti Park, and he was like hollering, yeah, you get in. You know, he wanted to be down there, and he was only like 13 at the time. And so it kind of, you know, plays really well with his personality, the Elijah Wheat Showroom. And we try to show artists that, again, instigate conversation and buck the status quo and are underrepresented in their way. And we want to be generous to those artists that are willing to share their voice, opposed to, you know, kind of a commercial venue.
What was that move like? I mean, what was it like going from the Swimming Pool Project to...
We had about a 4-year break, I guess, in between. And like Carolina was saying, when we first went back to do a fair in Chicago, suddenly our name wasn't said Brooklyn. But when we moved to Brooklyn from Chicago, we had on our website, to be continued, new space, in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. and that lasted literally for 4 years because we just didn't get it going right away due to day jobs and things like that. And also to find the right space with the right, right. location, the right deal, something we could afford, and then also start to meet artists that are local because
right.
it's hard to draw an emerging crowd oftentimes with an unknown name. So local artists was something we were also going for. But yes, there was a 4-year break. We ran the swimming pool project space for 3 years in Chicago and did about 30 shows there as well.
Wow.
And I'd say the swimming pool was a little less political in general, but still showed emerging artists. And a lot of those artists have gone on to be quite successful in mid-career and had museum shows and things like that since then.
What do you think about the New York art scene that's come to exist in Bushwick and Bed-Stuy versus the Chicago art scene?
I know there are some similarities and some differences. In terms of the Bushwick art scene, there's probably like 60 galleries in Bushwick. I found this yeah. map recently and I was really surprised because we know of some galleries in Bushwick and some little hot spots, you know, too. Like if you go into the Bogart building or something, there's 15 galleries in there. I'm not sure how many I might be misquoting.
Like even Hood Gallery that was in a trailer. And then now the, what was the gallery that Elisa Morel had, the secret spot?
Oh, the parking spot.
The parking, the secret project. No, that secret project robot was a different one, but that's like the dungeon or what is it?
There's all these alternative spaces.
And then the alternative spaces, what I was going to mention about Chicago, that's a big difference because Chicago was doing alternative space. And, you know, possibly Bushwick was a long time ago too, or other areas that aren't, you know, the hotspot now. But those apartment galleries were part of the community where it's just one night shows.
Mm-hmm. I think here, like, we just went to a show in a parking garage. That's why mm-hmm. I say it.
Yeah.
It's that and the gallery that Lena's talking about in the container.
Yeah.
Those are similar to things that happened in Chicago. People had galleries in their medicine cabinet, literally called medicine cabinet,
medicine
and that
cabinet.
Was a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
Or in their closet or on a ledge in their house that was called, like, ledge gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people kind of making their own thing happen so that they could get started in the gallery world is mm-hmm. a good way to make something happen because eventually people take notice of that. But it is always, you know, a situation where it's a passion project usually. And we're trying to bridge out of that by actually running a gallery and selling artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of galleries in Bushwick and Brooklyn are doing that. And especially galleries like Mrs. or,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have a lot of gallery friends that are, you know, going, that are very serious galleries.
Mm-hmm.
And
but possibly they're only open 2 days a week because they get the full-time day jobs. You know, Bible, you know, it's all black walls and on the Lower East Side / Chinatown, really.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's an alternative space, but they're showing some very interesting programming.
Started as a Bushwick gallery.
It started as a Bushwick gallery, both at with the GRC,
GCA,
excuse me, and Hood.
And
yeah.
Hood, yeah.
Yeah.
Combined. But yeah, I think people are making it happen, and depending on whether they have day jobs or not. And I think that's the similarity with Chicago, too. Everybody had a day job and did these, you know, backyard projects in a sense. But they end up taking you somewhere. And also they hold a place in, like, in the history of these artists and the history of the art culture inside the city.
Yeah, and it's cool to think that that's kind of coming back. It's funny because it's not my generation, you know, when we think of that first New York arts renaissance. So I'm curious to hear whether that's something that's like newly on the rise or whether that was how it was originally. You know, I think right now, like the art world is centered around these kind of mega galleries. So it's cool to see that things on the other end of the spectrum, things that are kind of passion projects that promote a different kind of art, you know, are kind mm-hmm. of a part of that ecosystem too.
Mm-hmm. And it's also a way to get into the ecosystem because if you didn't graduate necessarily from one of the big dog schools, you know, or maybe you did, but a lot of times it's hard to get your foot kind of going right away
yeah.
in the door. And so shows like this, like Carolina's given artists just out of undergrad their first solo show
mm-hmm.
and sold their work, sold tons of their work.
Mm-hmm.
And those are things that they have now on their resume, and then
yeah.
they'll go on to the next thing, and they might not have gotten a show or even known if they could get a show or known how to get a show. I think a lot of times, I mean, we've discovered people off of Instagram.
Yeah.
Which,
and that's a new thing for us.
Yeah, brand new.
Yeah. And typically we would choose young artists that we found very inspiring as, you know, we were recruiters for colleges like this University of Michigan, School of the Art Institute of Chicago, the New School, Parsons. And, you know, we would go around and we would review. We'd go to some of the hottest high schools all over the country. And certainly I went all around the world and found some really incredible, aspiring artists. And so we kind of were taking from that pool. They may not have gone to any of the schools we actually were employed by. They may have chosen other programs, gotten giant scholarships, and so on and so forth. But it's a testament to a lot of the artists that they stayed in connection with us. Where and beyond social media, you know, they just send emails, this is what I'm doing, we're on their mailing list. You can really see how the cream rises to the top and how young aspiring artists use their network in order to get that first show or get the recognition that they want or get, you know, their foot in the door for a group show and become curated into something. We get a lot of people coming through the gallery, and I know Liz gets a lot of questions as well. We each get a lot of questions about, like, well, how do you make it? Like, for instance, Liz, how did you get that gallery? How did they choose you, or what do you do? And I think that there's a lot of misconceptions about how to get your work out there, and we always share, I think Liz says it the best, so I'm going to leave it to her to kind of say, you know, the answer to young artists, like, how do you get a gallery, Liz Nielsen?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the last time we were, you know, when we were up at your studio in Newburgh, which I want to talk about Newburgh, but yeah, that, like, these simple questions that do come up, like I was at the Framer before I came here and I have to ship something to Texas. And I was thinking, like, oh my God, like, how am I going to ship this glass artwork to Texas that I'm breaking? And it's these simple things, I guess, we don't really think about, you know?
And then you thought, I better ask Liz.
Absolutely. I mean, better ask Liz.
I can help you with that. Definitely. But I mean, in terms of, yeah, I do think there's, it's literally in my mind, I'm always saying, one thing, just work hard, do your work, constantly do your work, because you never know when that moment is when someone's going to say, hey, what are you working on? Mm-hmm. And you have to be ready. You have to be, come over to my studio tomorrow. I'd love to show you. The studio visit is really how you get into any kind of group show first or eventually get a solo show. And also it's through your friends. So your friends hopefully are in the art scene, and if they're not, then you need to start going to a lot of gallery openings and
get new friends.
Yeah, and I mean, I know you know that, but it's not necessarily get new friends, it's just like,
no, I know,
go and meet people, because if someone sees you in the same spot 15 times, they're likely going to be, I've seen you here before. And what about
when you were a young artist, what were the first pieces you made? Were you always calling you a photographer, you know?
Well, but. No, yeah. My first pieces I made that I actually showed, I used to paint and draw, but my first pieces I made that I actually showed was photography, and it was black and white photography. And I actually cannot remember how I ended up getting into the show, but I'm trying to even remember if I had a solo show. I think I might have. Now it's a black.
Your
I'm
first one was a
on
solo
this.
One.
Maybe no. I don't think it was. I'm just trying to remember. But I showed at this gallery. It was in Ballard in Washington, and I showed black and white photographs. And I sold art. I sold like 3 or 4 pieces.
What were the photographs like?
They were of people in architecture, black and white people in architecture.
Wow.
Just like I was carrying my camera around all the time, and I continued to do that for years, and I still take pictures, but not as much as I used to. I literally used to go out like every single time. It was the time right before the sun sets, like at dusk, and photograph that blue time in the night. Like I did that when I was shooting color. I did that like every single night, no matter who I was with or what I was doing. I would say like, I gotta go do something for like 20, 30 minutes. With black and white, I just carried my camera around all the time. I would wake up early and go walk the streets and take photographs. I don't know what.
Who were the, so kind of like street photography, I
yeah,
guess?
Yeah, I definitely was doing street
that
photography.
Walk around.
You're still doing
I'm
street
still doing
photography.
Street photography. In fact, just don't now, see it's, it. Now it's actually more street than and in a literal way. Like I photograph the sidewalk.
Oh,
mostly.
Yeah. I know. I've seen a couple of those, right?
But I used to be looking up more. Mm-hmm. And now I'm just staring at the ground a lot with my camera.
It's funny. I found that like a lot of people who start in photography, they start with street photography. Mm. Like, no matter what their, I mean, your work now, I mean, it couldn't be any farther from street photography. But I think it's almost like when people think of street photography as like the medium or photography as the medium, street photography is like kind of the first thing that or in the kind of common.
Yeah, it's because if you take a class, and even when I teach classes, yeah. you tell your students to go out and look for something specific and photograph that. Or, you know, you give them some sort of assignment where they're literally just, like, walking around somewhere. You can take them somewhere mm-hmm. on a train and then just say, like, take pictures. Yeah. And I remember my first photo class. I used to blow my entire roll of film literally on the way to class, which means my pictures looked awful. Totally crap.
But you were excited.
No, I wasn't.
It was last minute.
I actually took the class originally because I thought it would be like an easy A. Oh,
okay,
which
all right.
Which
so you were like, shit, I gotta go to class. I gotta finish this roll
of
film.
Yeah, which I think I kind of skidded by with like a B minus, which I was
B minus
pretty
much
an A
one.
Student. Mm-hmm. So in general, so I was like, wow, that was not good. But I remember other students in the class coming to class with really cool photographs. Like they did the assignment, like they tested every single shutter speed and things like that. Whereas I put mine on automatic and just shot the film. And my teacher was like, I can tell you put this on automatic. And I was like, oh really? Like how? Even exposures.
What yeah.
But she was a philosophy major, so she wasn't even an art major.
I was a philosophy Spanish major, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Spanish too.
Yeah. So I just took photo. And then I got hooked though. And I actually went back to art school. So I graduated without an art degree for my mm-hmm. first time through school.
And when do you remember when you made the first cameraless pictures?
Yeah. Let's see. My first cameraless pictures probably, I mean, realistically getting going on them was like 2012. Mm. So I was working with light since 2002, abstract light. Mm-hmm. Like, taking photographs, setting up all kinds of stuff, and just photographing light. But I was using the camera. And then I started taking light and shining it into the camera. And I did that for years. And I was working like with these sort of space kind of things. Like originally, like they looked like landscapes, but very abstract expressionist style. Mm-hmm. And then they moved into this sort of spacey, but they were performing in front of the camera. So there's all this sort of movement and trails, but they were based on objects. And I had fog machines and smoke and fabrics and LED lights and everything. Cool. And then it was not till we moved to New York, really, that I started doing completely cameraless. I mean, I'd done things like photograms, of course, but in New York, I got here and I had left my teaching job in Chicago and I didn't have access to great equipment. And when I first got here, I didn't have a job at all. So there was also like a thing where it's like, well, I want to make work. I want to make big negatives because I like the clarity of the result of a big negative. Mm-hmm. And with lower funds, I thought I'll just make the negatives myself.
Right.
And then that was sort of the beginning of it, I guess.
You guys met in Chicago, right?
Mm-hmm. We met in Chicago. Mm-hmm.
So what's the story there? How does this fit into the timeline?
I suppose... What were we saying? It was 2005.
Yeah, I think we met.
Because it was right before Katrina. We remember that. Mm-hmm. And we met in the bathroom. And we just happened to be both there in the same time. I was washing my hands and Liz was popping her collar in the mirror. So I'm looking at myself, washing my hands, and this brown haired, asymmetrical lady has a t-shirt on with a pearl necklace print. And I kind of smirked to myself and said, I like your t-shirt, it's funny, because I see it underneath her button down. And she was like, oh, let me show you. And so she revealed opening up the buttons, like a Liechtenstein-esque print of a woman saying, I love my pearl necklace. And I just thought it was so sexy and so funny. But however, I went back to the office and I just met the coolest girl in the bathroom, and at this point I'd probably say woman, but she was like, oh, and I described her. She goes, oh, you must have met lesbian Liz. And I'm like, no, she's definitely not a lesbian. She's got a pearl necklace t-shirt on her, you know, brown hair is like long on one side. And the woman at the front desk, her name is Tomiko. She's a really wonderful part of our meeting story. She goes, yeah, you mean Blizza? She like break dances. She's a photographer. Her girlfriend's on this floor. Trust me. I know. Oh, wow. I went to school with her. So anyway, so then we ended up, I saw her work. I thought I was really impressed. And I was working in the admissions office and I needed recruiters. So I asked her to help out, and her resume had already been there. And so it was easy to kind of push the hiring process. And then we got to go on trips together and could do a little training. She was also trained by another friend of ours and who ended up marrying us. And then, so I guess that's kind of the story. We were friends for 3 good years before we started dating at all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're really like best friends. We just became so close, like kindred. And I was speeding in the car down back from Milwaukee to Chicago one day, and it was scaring the living crap out of her as she tells the story. And she was on her Razor phone texting, like, "Oh my God, save my life!" with one of her friends. I'll be there. And I just turned to her and I said, "I think I'm going to know you for a really long time. I think we're going to be friends for a really long time. I swear. Maybe I'd only met her for maybe a month." In the meantime, Liz is thinking.
I was just thinking, well, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I wasn't really sure at that point.
Like, yeah, sure.
Lena already knew. She had that feeling of like, mm-hmm. I'm in it to win it.
Yeah, but Liz was really slow burn.
I'm a slow burn. Yeah. I don't know why I'm like that. I mean, I'm very friendly and I naturally like people in general. Mm-hmm. In terms of getting really close, like it takes me a little while.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Our anniversary is actually the night the swimming pool opened for the first time.
That's when we first kissed. Night of the swimming pool.
Well, that's mm-hmm. kind of serendipitous. Tell me about the night.
Before I tell you about the night, I want to tell you that I first opened the swimming pool or got the swimming pool as a studio. Oh. I rented it as a studio. And then as soon as I was in it, I was like, this is such a gallery space. Gosh, I should start a gallery in here.
So tell me, I am in my mind, I'm picturing a swimming pool. So get me where I need to be.
It was basically what it was is an old insurance office that was pretty run down. And you walked down the stairs into it. Mm-hmm. And I thought of how you go and descend into a swimming pool.
It's like
and
a little sunken space.
And then, then once I kind of decided, it was a storefront though. Mm-hmm. So once I thought, let me start a gallery. Let me just do it as a project for a few months, see how it goes. Yeah. I don't know. I hadn't really dreamed of starting a gallery. It came to me. Mm-hmm. And then I painted the floor blue, like swimming pool blue.
Yeah.
Because I decided I don't want a white box. And I always think about how you have really good conversations inside of a swimming pool.
Yeah.
Like, it's just somehow it's like easy to talk. And it's also because you're distracted by something else, like the water, and you're kind of moving. Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking, like, this will be a really great place to have good conversations about art. Mm-hmm. And then Lena and I had just, we were good friends at this point, but then we started dating, and that's how she ended up getting more involved with the swimming pool, and then eventually started curating shows and everything with me being fully involved.
Yeah, cool.
Originally, it was supposed to be a studio, but the thing was is the gallery just took off. It was so wonderful, and I kept finding artists, and it was just exciting, like, and it was happening, like people were coming, and sometimes it was getting so crowded that you just couldn't even get into the space. And
that's exciting.
It was a nice way to also present ideas, like, and engage in the community and present the community's ideas and have other curators come in and do shows in there as well, bringing in artists and different people. So the community of the gallery kept growing and growing and growing. And it was sad to leave, but it was such hard work because I worked in the admissions office with Lena, mm-hmm. ran the gallery, and taught undergrad at night. So it was really...
And you were an artist.
And I was an artist.
Yeah, four jobs.
So it was basically 7 days a week for 3 years straight that I worked. And at one point, I actually caught walking pneumonia, and my doctor was like, "You've got to rest." And I said, "I can't. What can we do? I just can't." And it was like, "You have to rest." But I just couldn't really slow down. So it took me about 2 or 3 months to get over it. Mm-hmm. And it was like a little bit of a sign for when we moved to New York, like, take it easy, which is a weird thing to say when you move to New York.
Yeah, it's, but people don't move here to take it easy.
But I did in the sense that I did one job and I didn't take on anything else for a while.
And she's offered teaching positions quite a bit. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities where she could just do one class or, you know, adjunct stuff outside of other things. Or even there's been a couple positions that are department heads or other things where she's been encouraged to imply. And Liz loves to teach so much, but she puts so much of her heart and energy into the students and into really creating a great environment, a safe space for folks to learn and be artists. That I did see her really expend her energy at a level of depletion.
Yeah.
So maybe let's talk about Newburgh. When did this project happen?
Okay, Newburgh is a great story because I had the studio in Bushwick, and it's a great studio. However, I feel like I was getting encroached upon by my own artwork.
Yeah.
Like, it was just, I make a lot, and it was just kind of crowding me, and I kept complaining about that. And so Carolina found this Orange County Art Council grant through one of our friends, Kelly, and who lives in Newburgh, and encouraged us to apply, and Carolina applied for me. She did the whole application. She won the grant. And so that's how it ended up happening, because then we decided, well, let's go do it, because it was a relocation, so we got the move covered and then a little bit extra, you know.
And then general. We also, our good friend Kelly and James both have properties there, and so they were able to give us the tips on what's good, what's, you know, a total lemon, and right. You know, how and so we liaised with a handful of folks that we were like, we're not paying Brooklyn prices for this. So that was, we were really thankful for them to introduce us to where we are right now. We wouldn't have had that space without them.
And Kelly, yeah, Kelly really helped
Kelly
us
really
find it.
She found it
she
for
found
us.
It, yeah. And then anyway, so it's a lot more space. So it's, that's amazing. You came up and visited.
And overlooking the Hudson.
We can turn part of, yeah, it's overlooking the Hudson.
Beacon Mountain.
I mean, it's a really amazing space, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It is, but it's freezing right now.
Yeah, so. I can imagine,
it's,
yeah.
It's so
it's
cold.
Like Arctic.
Electric blankets.
We have the electric blankets, but it's like even beyond that. So I think December and January, we really won't be there too much, probably. Depends if sometimes the weather hikes up. I remember Christmas a few years ago when it was like hot outside and we were wearing 60. T-shirts.
It's starting to get weird.
But also we turn the bedroom into a dark room and can make the work in
there. And
that's
where you're making the large photographs.
That's where I'm
now
making the large photographs. Mm-hmm. And we go in there together and take action. And then basically what I do is I roll up the photograph and put it in a light safe tube that fits in the diagonal of the backseat of our Volvo and drive it into the city, and we process it here so I can dip it through all the chemicals here.
Do you do it at My Own Color Lab?
I don't do it there because the larger stuff is 50 inches wide and My Own Color Lab is 40 inches wide.
Right.
But I print a lot at My Own Color Lab as well.
I was there yesterday and I was talking to Gerard and he brought up your work and it was really sweet.
I love Gerard. He's
I know,
a good
he's
guy.
Great.
Yeah, he had actually met Elijah. Elijah went into the dark room with him.
Oh, nice.
With Liz a couple times. Yeah.
Yeah, he did. I know. I love that.
No, he showed me your enlarger.
Oh yeah, that's great. That's so funny. I love that he said that because I wish that was my own enlarger, personal enlarger.
Uh-huh.
But people come and fly in from all over the country and the world to print there. So actually, I've met so many fantastic other photographers.
It seems to be a good community built around that place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So sometimes my enlarger is taken, and I always hold a good attitude and I'm flexible because basically, when it comes down to it, I don't always need the enlarger. Mm-hmm. I half the time just need a room that's dark,
right?
That's
you're
near
making
the chemicals.
A direct print, a unique print.
And some of my prints, I'm using the enlarger, and I'm working directly on. And some of the works are enlarged, but the photogram is basically on a plate on top of the enlarger. So, you know, several
light paintings,
several techniques,
cardboard
involved.
Cutouts. Yeah,
yeah.
I know a little bit about it, but do you want to bring us through the process of how they're made in the bedroom? Don't give away any of your secrets, but but to communicate it to someone, what do you tell them?
Well, we put cardboard in front of the window, so it's totally dark, mm-hmm. and then gaffer's tape on the door, so it's just pitch black, and then basically I cut the roll of photo paper, mm-hmm. and I've got the negative ready already in there, so it's the negative is many layers, and then I make the pieces exposure by exposure. Mm-hmm. And
sometimes up to 50 exposures.
Sometimes up to 50 exposures.
How long does it take to do a piece start to finish?
It depends.
Like, I mean, just the darkroom section of it.
The darkroom section, it's usually an hour about per piece. Depends
on how.
In the dark, yeah.
Wow.
I know. Sometimes I'll say, like, can we do one more? Like, it's a big time commitment.
Yeah.
And plus, we're usually working at night because a little bit of light
the
could seep
light
in,
yeah.
mm-hmm. and you just can't have it. So that's also what's great about Newburgh is there's not just stray light to mm-hmm. seep in.
So, I mean, it must have taken kind of a lot of practice to know where your marks are in that room. I mean, do you lose orientation?
You would be surprised. I knock myself into tables and things all of the time. At the same point, like, I know where things are with my hands that I've already laid out. So, like, I can always feel, you know, where something is. And I mark things with tape, and I have different standing points at different parts of, and I move around the whole photogram because they're so large. So it's not just from mm-hmm. one spot that it's built or created or moved or anything. So, yeah, but I think I probably knock myself into a table or something often, but it's planned and smooth and for the most part in terms of how it happens.
At this point, we now have a cat attack.
I'm having the cat attack my recorder, and I don't want him to change the levels.
Oh my God.
Ryan, come on.
Seriously.
Jeez Louise. Jeez. Yeah. But it is. Liz really is a wizard in the dark room, I must say, having been blessed to be with her as she makes work and helping her wield some of these larger 100, you know, inch long 50 inch wide pieces, you know, the kind of light painting and things that she does is so planned, and it's she's so particular about where all of her devices of, you know, lights are, all her frequencies of color, and it's really scientific how she works. And sometimes you know, she's a little hard on herself if something doesn't go right. So I tried to record her once. Can I say this?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, a lot of people ask, like, well, why don't you get an infrared camera? Why don't you record her making this work? Because it's so performative and so large,
yeah,
and just working on the table and, like, up and down and it's all in the dark. Yet, you know, Liz is really objected to that idea because it is fairly secret, but it's very planned, and it, you know, a lot of folks will ask how long it takes, just like you, William. And really, it's 1 hour plus 20 years.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know,
yeah.
And one time I tried to record her. We were in San Francisco in Rayco Lab, and she was making a lot of the work for the show that was
Danziger.
Is the name of that show again, baby?
It was called The Medium.
Oh, The Medium. That's right.
Right.
And
great show.
Which we thought was apropos.
Thank
but
you.
The recording turned out to just be like, expletive.
All I did was curse the entire time.
Yeah.
And it was funny for me because I didn't realize I was that angry in the dark room, but I am. Like, I usually,
I would say particular.
Yeah.
You're wrestling
particular.
Light. I mean, it's the
light.
Hardest thing to control.
Yeah.
You know?
And so basically what happens is, like, I'll be planning to get an orange or like a pastel pink or something. And for some reason I'm constantly thinking that I'm off, you know, and a lot of times I'm on, totally on, and in the end I did exactly what I thought I was going to do.
But there's a moment of self-doubt where it's like, maybe you didn't do it. And I know just to do exactly what she tells me. Step back. No, go over there. Just move on. Is that your phone?
Really
no questions.
I'm just like, go.
I'm super bossy. I'm super bossy in the dark room.
I can take it. It's okay.
Lena can take it. It's just like, there's been times, one time she hid her phone, like, totally underneath all this stuff, but I could see it while I was working. I was like, something's this blue light in there. You know, and honestly, a stray blue light in the corner is probably not going to do anything unless it bounces off of something, but it would give me yellow on the paper, mm-hmm. and I might not want that.
Yeah.
You know, a stray, like, red light of a number, if you're in the enlarger room, will give you blue. So it's always, like, these moments of what's it bouncing off of, too. Like, the walls are white in there, so they could bounce, mm-hmm. and they can, and they will.
And they do.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, just color and I imagine the way that most people think about color in terms of pigment, in terms of like how colors mix, it's not the opposite, but it's a completely different ballgame when you're mixing light, you know, with color. And
yeah.
It must be just like understanding the time that it takes to get a certain shade. And I mean, it must be really hard to manage.
It is, like, you do have to do the adding because, you know, if you want to make, you know, one color, you might have to add half of that color will be like a longer time. You know, like, anytime you're using red, you have to add it longer because red is a little wimpy on the wavelength. I mean, it's an amazing, but mm-hmm. and it, you have to do twice, three times, four times, five times as long as, like, if you hit the paper with, like, a blue or purple.
Cool. Well, I know you guys have to run, so let's call it there. But thank you so much.
You're welcome. We're running actually to get the lease because we now have a year lease for the Elijah Wheat showroom.
Oh, really amazing! That's great.
About it, and yes, our first show,
of course, on Saturday. next show to open an Elijah Wheat showroom.
Yeah, this Saturday is called Slap the Void. Mm-hmm. Frances Waite, new works on paper, and she is just an incredible artist. Liz had mentioned that she had just graduated from Pratt, and I basically found her on Instagram through one of our former students that I was following that ended up going to Pratt. They happened to be friends, and I was really interested in her work. And anyway, her work is so apropos, really, really appropriate right now for what's happening with the Me Too campaign, what's happening with all of these investigations for sexual harassment and, maltreatment and just basic sexism is being brought out. But her work is quite sexually forward and empowering for females and really quite vulnerable. And we're just really excited to be showing it. And I'm a little bit nervous, too, about possible feminist backlash. But I think I have a strong force of reasoning behind it, as will she. But anyway, thank you so much, William.
Thank you.
Thanks, William.
I'd like to extend a big thank you to Liz Nielsen and Carolina Wheat, as well as to Danziger Gallery, SoCo, Black Box Projects, Horizont, and Next Level. Also, remember to go see Persistence of Future Memories at Eliza Wheat Showroom. This show is produced by Sarah Levine. Our music is by Jack and Eliza, who incidentally have two new songs out with their new project Purr, which you can find on SoundCloud. And finally, as I said before, you can also see my portrait of Liz and Carolina on Instagram at William Jess Laird. Thanks so much for listening.